This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Revolution for Dummies, Laughing Through the Arab Spring by Bassem Youssef. This is the author. To my daughter, Nadia, you are a very hard act to follow. My unborn children will have to come up with unthinkable feats just to match your level of awesomeness. To my wife, I know you didn't expect this kind of marriage or life, but hey, not a dull moment, baby. Without your patience, resilience, and support, I wouldn't have amounted to anything. To my older brother and my friend, Tamer Youssef, you are all that is left after our parents departed this world. You are all that remains of an Egypt I once knew. Author's note, or why did I buy this book again? You might expect me to narrate the epic events of the Arab Spring, to tell you the details of the geopolitical and sociological circumstances, whatever that means, that led to the various Arab revolutions throughout the Middle East, and the great hopes and aspirations that came with them. You might expect me to give you an in-depth analysis of how everything there now seems to be a total desperate mess. But do you really care about that? Be honest. Don't you just want to make it seem like you understand the Middle East by dropping knowledge bombs? At least these don't hurt on your friends. But you'd rather hear it from the Egyptian guy you saw a couple of times on The Daily Show? I mean, even people from my country stopped caring about why we are a shit show a long time ago. For us, in the Middle East, injustice, oppression, and the insanity of justifying them are now just an integral part of our government-sponsored daily news. Nothing surprises us anymore. We have somehow embraced the failure, disappointment, and futility of what everything has become, the same way you guys embrace PBS. You don't know why it's still on the air, but somehow, you've all accepted it. Plus, if you really wanted to get an objective, in-depth study about what the hell is happening in the Middle East, you'd go get a book published by some wonky think tank in Washington. There are dozens of these books claiming they've got the answer for what the hell is happening there, yet the Middle East is still a big mess. So, either no one is reading these books, or even heavily funded policy institutions don't know jack shit about us. So, let me give you some advice. If you think you are ever going to truly understand what is happening in the Middle East, stop. Instead of giving you some underwhelming history lesson, I'm going to tell you my story. What happened to me while the revolution occurred and my unexpected role within it. Yeah, sure, my story makes me sound important, but really it is just a ploy to keep you interested. Hell, you might think I am an arrogant son of a bitch for thinking that people would buy a book just to hear my story, and you are right. Who the fuck do I think I am? But then again, you're just the same country that published and bought biographies about Paris Hilton and Heidi Montag. Hell, even Fabio wrote a fucking book. So, if you're looking to read about fake boobs, sex tapes, or a man with long blonde hair who half-nakedly rides a horse, then you're right. You won't care about my story. But the problem is, I have already received an advance from the publisher, which I have already spent. So either I come up with a book, or hustle my way through paying back the advance. And since I can't really escape the publisher by fleeing back to my country, from which I had to escape more than 2 years ago, more on that later, I might as well write the goddamn book. How my story is not already in development to be an awards season darling is beyond me. Picture this. An Arab man, played by Javier Bardem with an accent, because, you know, Hollywood's diversity problem, grows up to save a few lives as a heart surgeon. But when a whole region experiences the biggest clusterfuck in its history, he saves the whole nation with his jokes. The writers might have to take some liberties in order to write a happy ending and appeal to an American audience, but enjoy your second Oscar, Javier. However, the movie has yet to be made. So, you're just going to have to listen to this audiobook. Through it, you'll see how ignorance, xenophobia, racism, and everything that Donald Trump stands for can transcend borders, cultures, and religions. You'll find how easy it is to brainwash masses of people. however well-informed they think they are, without the funding of Fox News, the pure hatred that is Ann Coulter, or the Bible. After the fame and the short-lived celebrity life I had in Egypt, my story is all I have left. So, consider me your companion for the next 70,000 words. Yes, that's the minimum the publisher asked for. If you're lucky, listening to this book may incite an interesting conversation or fight at a bar. In certain parts of the country, I bet you look and sound exotic, i.e., un-American, reading a short history of the Arab Spring through the eyes of the John Stewart of Egypt. If you're liberal, you'll attract other liberals, you know, being interested in the matters of the world and shit. If you're really lucky, you might even get laid tonight by some hot chick. If you're a woman, that last sentence is totally sexist and was planted in there by my editor. And if you are a Republican, well, I'm sorry. That must be really tough for you. Most books about the Arab Spring start on January 25th, 2011, when the Egyptian Revolution officially began. It's the logical jumping-off point, and trust me, we will get there. But remember, this book is also about me, and I am the one writing it. So, let's jump forward a couple of years and start with something to really grab you, like the time I was trying to flee from my own country to become an ex-funny man, a fugitive on the run. Part 1. A Heart Surgeon Breaking Bad. Exodus on Emirates Airlines. November 11, 2014. Cairo doesn't have any traffic lights. Well, it really does. But the streets are regulated by the sheer volume of vehicles chugging through its lanes, all trying to get somewhere while getting nowhere. This is how you know you are in an Arab country. You are either stuck in a revolution or in traffic. Egypt has the distinction of having both. On November 11th, stalled in that same notorious traffic, I was dead silent. I kept refreshing my Twitter feed, noting that the news of the verdict against me had yet to break. Abbas, my friend who was accompanying me, asked if I was doing okay. I mumbled that I was fine. As the chaos of the streets reeled around me, I looked outside the window and saw an old billboard with my face on it. Not many months ago, this face was on almost every billboard in every main street in Cairo, the face of the most popular show in Egypt and the Arab world. Tariq, my friend in Dubai, kept calling Abbas' phone to get updates on our status. "We haven't arrived yet at the airport," Abbas answered. "Yes, Emirates Airlines. Flight is on time. We'll tell you when we pass the customs check." Tariq had escaped Egypt a year before me. Never did I think I would be following in his footsteps and running from the same country that voted me the most popular media personality 3 years in a row. What's a popularity contest worth if it doesn't offer immunity from political exile? "Do you think they let me travel?" I asked Abbas in a low voice so the driver wouldn't hear. "Or do you think they have already put me on a no-fly list?" "Don't worry, everything will be fine," he said. Both of us knew these were just empty words to comfort me. Many of the other journalists and activists in Egypt had already been banned from traveling. The question was, whose time was next? We finally arrived at the airport, and I unloaded my two bags on the street. It was all I could hastily pack in 90 minutes. I looked at the airport building, then back to Cairo's skyline. I wondered if this would be the last time I set eyes on it. How did it come to this? Why did I have to flee while tyrants and thieves got to stay? I didn't steal, didn't abuse my powers, and certainly didn't hurt anyone. All I did was tell jokes. I wheeled my bags through the terminal and then peeked at my boarding ticket. Destination, Dubai. Destiny, unknown. Close Encounters with a Revolution. We live in an era of instant gratification in which we crave meaningless recognition. Shares of our inflated achievements on Facebook, retweets of our 140 characters of fake wisdom on Twitter, and likes for the stupid photos of meals we are about to eat. and will inevitably shit out 36 hours later on Instagram. Instant gratification might be achieved from social media, but it really doesn't work the same way for revolutions. Imagine a revolution succeeding just because of the sheer number of shares, likes, or retweets. Wouldn't that be something? On January 25th, 2011, the Egyptian revolution started. On February 11th, 2011, Hosni Mubarak, the 30-year dictator, stepped down. Wait, who the fuck is Hosni Mubarak? And isn't Egypt in Africa? Why the hell did you need an Arab Spring in Africa? I know I said I wasn't going to give you a second-rate history lesson on the Middle East, but I've got to catch you up to speed at least a little bit. For many Americans, Egypt, Muslim, Arabs, Africa might not fit in the same sentence. The thing is, we're all that, and much more, baby. Yeah, sure, our ancestors built the pyramids. And I know you've seen our pharaohs and gods make appearances in some of your blockbuster movies. Like when Australian actor Joel Edgerton was the obvious choice for Ramses II in the terrible movie Exodus, Gods and Kings. Or how about when Scottish actor Gerard Butler played Set, deity of chaos and war, in that piece of crap, Gods of Egypt. The parade of movie-making garbage goes on and on. Not to mention we rarely even get credit for the amazing monuments our great-great-great-great-great-great-great, you get the picture, great-grandparents left behind. Typically, that glory goes either to the Jews or a bunch of aliens. But then, when I see what decades of dictatorship have done to my country, I say to myself, you know, maybe it wasn't us. We are the African nation who thought it could do better but ended up doing nothing. We don't speak Egyptian, just like you don't speak American. We are an Islamic country that speaks Arabic. And although we are a Muslim country, we do have a small population of Christians. So you can just think of us as a reverse United States, religion-wise. Also worth noting, we don't ride camels to work. And our women aren't all belly dancers. A disappointment, I know. Politically, we've gone from pharaohs to khedives, whatever the hell that means, to presidents. By the time we reached 2011, Hosni Mubarak was a third-generation president, essentially meaning that he was the third president of Egypt since Egypt started a love affair with military regimes. Calling it a love affair is being generous, though, as it is more of a domestic abuse situation in which the wife is battered, bruised, and brainwashed into thinking that her husband really loves her. And it only took 18 days to kick to the curb the dictator who ruled us for 30 years. 30 years, also known in the Middle East as a short first term, was the life expectancy of our leaders in the Middle East. You might find it strange or unusual, but isn't that better than what you see in a backward Western democracy like the United States? You guys spent over $5 billion this past election just to get a president for 4 years? That's like throwing a massive new wedding for your spoiled brat daughter every 4 years because she keeps marrying and divorcing rat schmucks like Ted Cruz and Chris Christie. You really need to revisit how democracy should work, guys. I mean, after all this money spending, you wound up with Donald Trump. In the Middle East, assholes come for free. You see, in the Arab world, we need to make long-term plans. And we can't just change them every 4 years because of the uncertainty of something trivial like elections. We have to plan ahead for our vacations, commitments, and jail time. Your democracy won't really cut it for us. Plus, you got Trump as president, so you're really not in a position to mock our democracy or our choices, even if we don't have any, of horrible leaders. So back to us. We had an 18-day revolution and believed it worked. But no revolution really happens in 18 days. Revolutions are like bloody, agony-inducing roller coasters that often end in fiery crashes of epic failure. So it seems we had the luxury of a short-term glory, but would spend the following 5 years paying our debt. I often get pissed when I see some American talk shows discuss how disappointed they are that our revolution of 18 days didn't work. This breed of Americans thinks that your Revolutionary War took the same time it took to shoot the movie The Patriot. Prior to our revolution, I wasn't an activist or remotely involved in any kind of politics. I was a heart surgeon. Let that sink in. I used to cut open people's chests for a living. By 2010, I had finished all my American medical license exams and I was desperately looking for a way to work in the US. Honestly, I never really liked being a doctor. It was just a great line to open a conversation with a hot chick. The conversation usually didn't go anywhere because I sucked at talking to women. But as a doctor, you get the added benefit of talking to women without them answering back while they are under anesthesia. Sick, I know. I had my fantasies of becoming a worldwide star, maybe an actor. By some miracle, I would win an Oscar and marry Jennifer Aniston in the process. But since there was no clear path to how to get there, I did the next best thing and became a nerd. You see, I come from a typical middle-class family. My father was a judge, my mom was a university professor, and my older brother was an engineer. Having a son as a doctor or an engineer is a coveted social status. Since I hated numbers and biology made more sense to me, I went to medical school to complete the family portrait. Now, my mother could brag about my son the doctor and my other son the engineer. I know, we almost sounded like a Jewish family. Even though I didn't like medicine, I tried to make the best of it. But working as a doctor in Egypt, in its ever-failing, underfunded, good-for-nothing healthcare system, puts a lot of pressure on you. I thought if I could work as a doctor but in a different country, I would at least feel better about what I did. So I put my nerd power into overdrive and passed every single possible exam to get the hell out of there. I finally found an opening in Cleveland. I was excited that this might be my way out. Nothing can tell you how desperate I was to get out of my country, like getting pumped about going to Cleveland. Basically, the way I felt about Egypt was the same way LeBron James felt about Cleveland when he moved to Miami. One man's Cleveland is another man's Miami. Before 2011, I was politically apathetic. This is a normal feeling after having lived with the same president for 30 years. We were even waiting for Mubarak, the ailing dictator, to push his son into his place. It was something like the Bush and Clinton dynasties, but without elections, transparency, competition, accountability, or anything. If an Arab president decides his son is the next president, you can object, but it won't change anything. As a matter of fact, the dictator can be dead already, and the powers that be will bring his son from London, change the constitution since the son is younger than the required age, and usher him into the presidency. That exact sequence happened in Syria with Bashar al-Assad, so why not with us? When January 2011 came along, I was waiting for my visa papers to arrive from Cleveland when something radically unusual happened. Hundreds of thousands of people took to the streets. Where did all those people come from? There was a mix of young and old people with a hodgepodge of beliefs, yet there were no religious slogans, no complicated chants. They were shouting, "Down, down, Hosni Mubarak." There are many stories of why people took to the streets. Maybe the most circulated one was about a Facebook page calling for a demonstration dedicated to renouncing police brutality in the wake of a young student being tortured and killed by the police. Careful, America. The other unofficial story was that the Arab Spring started in Tunisia, which inspired young people in Egypt. We were not going to be upstaged by this small puny motherfucking country called Tunisia. Egypt is way bigger, cooler, and older than Tunisia, obviously. So yeah, there is a high probability that we may have started our revolution because we were simply attention whores and drama queens. Call us the Kardashians of the political world. If you were in the streets, it looked like an uprising, a revolution, with thousands out there demanding their freedom and for Mubarak to step down. But the national networks refused to broadcast the unrest. There was a nationwide split personality disorder on display, in which two separate realities existed simultaneously: the brutal reality of the streets and the tranquil reality of the TV. According to the TV media, this was not a revolution, but a conspiracy orchestrated by the CIA, Central Intelligence Agency, Mossad, Israel National Intelligence Agency, Hezbollah, Lebanese Shia Islamist Militant Group, Hamas, Palestinian Sunni Islamic Fundamentalist Organization, and maybe even the Village People, New York's super gay disco group from the 70s. Pundits were popping up all over the screen to tell us about the American Zionist conspiracy to bring down Egypt, citing evidence to support that Iran and Hamas were also involved. You can't make that shit up. With all those nations and security and intelligence agencies getting together to conspire against us, you would think that the Egyptian revolution had already succeeded in the one thing every contestant in every beauty pageant claims she wants to achieve, world peace. Those lovely youth in the streets don't know what they are getting themselves into, one pundit said. Our Egyptian youth are falling victim to international conspiracies put into effect by our enemies. It was as if he was saying, whoops, thousands of people just happened to accidentally take to the streets at the same time fundamentalist groups and counterintelligence agencies are looking to sabotage the Egyptian government. Sometimes if you switch on the TV, you would see the cameras fixed on an empty bridge or a tranquil view of the Nile. One channel's producer was so dumb that on a day when the camera was fixed on one of those bridges, he didn't realize that at the top of the screen, on another bridge, huge clashes between protesters and security forces were taking place, news programming at its finest. The protests heralded in a new chapter. The rich, the poor, the liberal, the Islamist, the Christian, all sharing this common place in Tahrir Square. For 3 days, I watched the clashes on international news networks and didn't know what to make of it. I was one of those people who saw the Tunisian dictator flee his country a few weeks before, and like many people, I never thought the same thing would happen in Egypt. Tunisians are one of the most educated populations in the Arab world. On the other hand, Egypt has one of the highest illiteracy rates in the region. Egypt is not Tunisia was the most repeated phrase on television. I, like many other Egyptians, believe that sentiment. Deep inside, we hated the regime, but after 30 years of political stagnation, we never thought that change could actually be possible. After 3 days of being cleared from the streets by the police, many protesters called for January 28th to be the day of anger, in which the protesters proclaimed that they would not leave the streets this time. On that day, the government made quite possibly the worst decision possible. They shut down mobile phone service across the nation. Now people with no communication would have to see for themselves what was happening in the square. News about masses of Egyptians pouring into the streets was circulating widely. My wife, Hala, whom I had married only a couple of months earlier, was scared. She fought with me because I wanted to go to the square. "Can't you see the clashes in the streets? I'm not ready to be a widow yet," she said. So I stayed home with her and watched the BBC and Al Jazeera channels, which were broadcasting live. The security forces seemed adamant that no one would come into the square that day. We witnessed something that we never thought we would see in our lifetime. Lines after lines of anti-riot police faced tens of thousands of protesters wanting to reach the square. The authorities considered this as an ultimate standoff, where all bets were made or lost on those 300 feet leading to the square. It was a scene that even Steven Spielberg couldn't come up with. I kid, he can do anything. After hours of clashes, endless amounts of tear gas, rubber bullets, and armored cars crushing protesters, it happened. Hundreds of black-suited, heavily armored men turned the other way and started running. We, the people, were chasing after the police. It was unbelievable to see it the other way around. The almighty face of authority fell right there and then. Decades of fear and awe inflicted by an authoritarian regime fell at the feet of the protesters, who ran over the police gear to take the square. Millions like me decided to come down to the streets to see it with our own eyes. We felt we had entered a post-apocalyptic movie set. Hey, maybe it was Spielberg after all. There was the heavy smell of gas from the clashes the night before, mixed with the smoke rising from burned, well, everything. Shops and cars were completely destroyed. People were dancing and singing on destroyed police armored vehicles. Others were preparing for a long sit-in by setting up makeshift hospitals, organizing places to stay, and handing out food, while looters took over the burned-out building of the ruling party. We saw people running away with office chairs and even AC units. The LA riots looked pedestrian by comparison. As we approached the middle of the square, things were a little more organized. No looting or chaos there. Protesters were already setting up what would, in a few days, become the main stage. Checkpoints were being formed and huge banners prepared. The biggest of all read, "The people demand the fall of the regime." It rolls off the tongue a little better in Arabic. And then, of course, there were photographers, news reporters, and television crews. I passed by an American reporter from ABC interviewing one of the men setting up the tents. She was having difficulty understanding his poor English. I volunteered to translate and her face lit up as if to say, "Oh, thank God, someone speaks our language." I think I stole that guy's thunder, but it was time for me to make my TV debut. I can't remember what she asked me exactly, but I remember saying, "Mubarak has already fallen." She was surprised and asked me, "Isn't it a bit premature for that assumption?" "I don't know if what I'm saying is making any sense or not," I replied. "I'm no politician or analyst, but I think Mubarak will fall, will be captured, and will be put on trial." "Oh, how cute and delusional at the same time," her smile seemed to say, which left me with a feeling that I was either too optimistic or just plain stupid. The jury is still out. My relationship with Tahrir Square over the next few days was a casual one. I didn't stay overnight, but would visit every day as my wife and I distributed food to the people staying there. Despite the festive mood inside the square, something else was happening on the outside. Hundreds of thugs started appearing everywhere along the roads leading to the square. These paid thugs were an effective weapon used by the police for the past 30 years. They were used to suppress minor demonstrations, so it would seem that a struggle between different factions of people had occurred. These thugs were also used to scare voters from entering polling stations during elections. They would later be employed by the authorities to do their dirty work without getting uniformed police involved. Not to mention, they would be the ones to attack my studio 3 years later. These thugs had had a name for years, and it was coined by the state-run media: honorable citizens. Over the next couple of years, we would become very familiar with their faces. You didn't need an officer in uniform to scare you. Fear came in many forms. The thugs were stopping cars going to Tahrir, looking inside them to see if their occupants had any Egyptian flags. If flags were found, it could only mean that you were going there to celebrate with the defectors. In the US, not standing for the flag is considered unpatriotic. In 2011, carrying the Egyptian flag could get you in trouble. One day, my wife and I drove towards the square, not carrying flags or banners in the car, but food supplies to offer to the people. We were stopped at a checkpoint controlled by those thugs when a guy came up to the car holding a thick stick. The scars on his face gave off a distinct "do not fuck with me" look. "Where are you going?" he asked. "We are going to Tahrir Square," I answered politely as my wife's body shook. He looked in the back seat and noticed the shopping bags. "What is this? Food? You better leave right now or else your car will be trashed." We turned back but managed to arrive at Tahrir through a more secure entrance, facilitated by the protesters. For 3 days, I divided my time between those visits and my work in the hospital. On one of those days, Mubarak appeared on TV to deliver a sentimental speech that actually made a difference. He pledged that he would never run for president again, which caused many protesters to leave the square because they believed in his speech's emotional rhetoric. Still, many remained because they didn't trust the authorities or because they thought it was a trick and that once they cleared the square, they would all be arrested for treason. It was early in the afternoon of February 2nd when something bizarre happened as we watched the TV at the hospital. People with camels and horses started attacking the square. Not armored vehicles, not security forces, but fucking camels and horses. Now I know that I have already joked that Egyptians don't ride camels to work, even though our region has been living in the 7th century, but this was just too much. The official story was that workers around the pyramids and tourist sites were complaining that there were no more tourists because of the clashes and the unrest. So they went to Tahrir to protest the protests. What had really happened was a full-on attack by tourist site workers supported by hundreds of those honorable citizens thugs to disband the protesters. The regime was trying to tell the world that there were two sides of this conflict, and they weren't the people versus the regime, they were people versus people. However, one of the only reasons there were pro-Mubarak forces involved was because people were being bribed and coerced into supporting the authorities. At this point, a decision was made by everyone at the hospital to go to the center of the action. The nurses prepared medical supplies, and before you knew it, everyone had made their way to the clashes. The square, nearly empty that morning, was now full, as street wars erupted right there in the middle of Cairo. Each section of Tahrir Square seemed to represent a different reality. There were the war zones on the periphery, where there was a constant exchange of rocks and Molotov cocktails. There were the areas right in the center, where people sang and danced like it was the Egyptian version of Woodstock. Then there were parents coming to visit the square with their children to buy food from street vendors offering sandwiches and tea. The variety of action was absurd. I remember the first time I went to the main clinic to check on those who had sustained injuries during the unrest. I spent around 8 hours treating all kinds of injuries. Then patients whom I stitched up headed directly back to the firing line, only to return with fresh injuries. I decided to leave the main clinic and make my way to some of the makeshift clinics on the periphery of the square, where I was only a couple of 100 meters from the hot zone. If I am going to be in the middle of a revolution, why not witness the action from a better seat? I told myself. You should know that I am not a violent person. The last fight I was involved in happened in 8th grade, and I had my ass handed to me by a guy 2 years my senior. Years later, I decided to take up boxing, and 6 months into it, I got a bad black eye in a practice fight with an Egyptian boxing champion. I'd like to say you should have seen the other guy, but he was fine. Violence is just not my thing, but now I was tempted to take an active role and join those brave demonstrators. So I approached the protesters on our side that were defending the square. They were holding huge sheets of metal taken from a construction site nearby to form barricades. I decided that this was it, my big chance to be a part of the resistance. I picked up a stone from the ground and walked a few steps closer to the front line. I gathered my courage and really let it fly. That throw was emblematic of my inability to physically fight an enemy, because my hand slipped, and instead of projecting the stone over the barricades to hit our attackers, I threw it straight ahead, nearly hitting one of the protesters on our side. One guy looked back to check out who the fucking traitor was. Thankfully, I was wearing a white doctor's coat, which gave me some sort of moral status and deflected his suspicions. I turned the other way as innocently as possible and decided to continue treating injuries instead of causing them. Up until the moment I treated one of those thugs, I didn't really understand why they were attacking the square. But then some protesters came over and asked me to verify a story told by one of the captured thugs. "We just captured this man who is claiming that he is on kidney dialysis and he needs to leave or he will be very sick. Can you verify that?" I was asked. They led me to the entrance of the metro station where they were keeping their prisoners of war. The man cried out to let him go. I asked him how he had gotten involved in the first place, and he told me a similar story told by most of the thugs there, that many of them were either addicts or poor and had been rounded up by senior thugs who gave them money to go and purify the square of the traitors. Some of them mentioned the names of prominent figures from the ruling party. I examined the guy and found out that he was indeed on dialysis treatment. "When you have nothing to eat, you will do anything for £200, he told me. I asked the protesters in charge to release him, which they did. They told me that every time they released someone to the army, however, the person would come back and attack our protesters again the next day. At that time, we still had faith in the army, though. We thought that when they took to the streets, that they were on our side, or at least being neutral. However, looking back, while the thugs and their camels attacked the square, the armed forces never interfered. We were in denial. Insert your own stupid denial joke here. And refused to think too much about it. Back then, we thought that the army would never betray us. How stupid we were. For everyone who visited, the square was a sacred, beautiful place where a powerful regime was toppled through mostly peaceful resistance. It would take us a few months to see that the regime hadn't fallen, nor did the square maintain its sanctity. Super Digitize Me. Let's go back a couple of steps to before all this happened. In Egypt, before 2010, internet basically consisted of Facebook and a few YouTube videos. There was no original Arabic content on it. It was around this time that Tariq, an old friend of mine, graduated as an engineer and became one of the first people in Egypt to start managing YouTube content. Little did he know he was jump-starting a major trend. For whatever reason, he came to me in the summer of 2010 and told me that he wanted to produce original content and use me as a host. "Why me?" I asked. "Well, you have a way," he said. "When you talk, people listen. I think if I put a camera on you, people will watch. You're not using me for porn, are you?" "I wish we had the women, bro," he answered. "I think you're a great choice for the internet. Also, you're my friend, so I can use you without paying you." I guess that settled it. At that time, politics was really off the table. As a matter of fact, in 2001, before there was something called YouTube, a group of five young people made a video spoof of one of the most popular Egyptian war movies. People were sharing it through videotapes and CDs and hard disks. Ultimately, all five people ended up arrested and interrogated by national security forces. They were eventually let go, but only after they confirmed they were just a bunch of stupid young men who didn't have any political agenda. Since politics was off limits, I decided to make my video debut about a less controversial topic, religion. I was really asking for it. I came up with a concept and settled on a title for the webisode, Searching for a God. Each episode was about a religion or a cult. I would discuss among some of their wacko beliefs in 5 minutes or less. This proves that I was ahead of Morgan Freeman by at least several years. I should sue him for stealing my idea with his new show, The Story of God. Screw you, Morgan. We shot 3 episodes and showed them to our friends, who loved the concept and the controversial content. I was already having dreams of fame, but at the same time was dying to work as a doctor in the States. Actually, I was dying to leave the country, and medicine was my only ticket out. So in my head, I reached a fantasy compromise. I would travel to the US, and in a couple of years, some huge TV exec would discover those episodes on the internet and hire me as the host of a show who goes around the world to film actual cults in their native countries. I would be the Anthony Bourdain of religions. Bassem Youssef, no revelations. End of fantasy. We set the release date for Searching for a God for New Year's Eve 2011. But that night, a bombing occurred outside a Coptic Christian church in the heart of Cairo. Yep, that's how we celebrate Christmas in my part of the world. That's why when I see Bill O'Reilly ranting for hours on end about a war on Christmas or the sacrilege of no red cups at Starbucks, all I can say is, bitch, please. Following that explosion, we decided not to release the videos on YouTube and postponed the whole thing for a few weeks. But 25 days later, all of a sudden, we just happened to have a revolution. You know, that little thing I started telling you about. And we lost sight of the project. There was nothing else for the next few weeks other than the events of the uprising. A week after Mubarak stepped down, Tariq called me. "Hey, forget about Searching for a God for now. We need a new project. Let's do something humorous and political. This is the best time for that kind of content." "Great," I said. "Then I want to do something like Jon Stewart, who, I should inform you, is my biggest inspiration." "What?" Tariq replied. "No one will get it. It won't work. Whatever, dude, just give me some content to put up there." I started collecting available online material from the Egyptian mainstream media. The widespread backlash against the media rose with the release of each new YouTube video. Now that Mubarak had stepped down and the revolution had won, those who had originally insinuated their revolution was a conspiracy, opposed it from the beginning, or instigated hate against it, found themselves on a sort of public blacklist. The hypocrisy and deception we found in those videos was unmatched. They were full of paranoia, hate, lies, and lots of sex. The Sex Orgy Revolution. With one camera, one desk, and one banner that cost $100, we filmed in the laundry room of my apartment. On March 8, 2011, we released the first 5-minute episode on the internet. It satirized how the media and celebrities tried to tarnish the protests in Tahrir Square. "We should get rid of those protesters in Tahrir," shouted a celebrity actor in the episode. "Why doesn't the army order a tank to advance in the square and shoot one shot, just one shot in the air? The traitors will flee and only the good people of Egypt will stay." A shot from a tank in the middle of Cairo? What could possibly go wrong? I'm sure a tank blast in the middle of Times Square would probably have a similar effect of separating the muggers from the good people of New York, right? I have been in Tahrir myself, added the same actor. I was there in disguise. I saw everything. This is not a revolution. People were dancing, singing, using drugs, and engaging in complete sexual relations. Someone had actually used the phrase complete sexual relations. Damn, who knew the revolution was just a glorified frat party? Yet for a nation with horny, sexually deprived youth, that image was the best motivation for more people to support the insurgents in Tahrir. If not for freedom, then at least for the hope of getting laid. And I couldn't help but ask the question, if they are complete sexual relations, what are the incomplete sexual relations? Is the man halfway in? Does the couple stop halfway through the act and smoke a joint? Do men who do not receive the whole complete sexual relations end up having blue balls? You see, sex is a great talking point in our region. If you want to discredit a person, a cause, or a whole movement, you can just drop accusations related to sex. It is the ultimate taboo. But that doesn't stop us from topping most countries when it comes to Pornhub.com searches. Maybe the next time Americans want to deal with a problem in the Middle East, they should send us strippers instead of troops. Middle East problem solved. For my first episode, I was hoping for about 10,000 views on YouTube, which would have been considered viral in Egypt. But in 2 days, the video hit 100,000 views. In 2 months, the show's views increased to 5 million. This was truly unprecedented in the Arab world. I know what you're thinking. 5 million? That is what my cat videos get now. 2011, people. 2011. People shared my videos on Facebook and on Twitter. They started to recognize me in the streets and stop me for photos. I was living a bizarre double life, working in the hospital during the week, and on the weekends, editing and shooting the episodes. The first videos were amateurish, but still, they were a huge hit. People enjoyed seeing me taking the piss out of the celebrities and TV personalities who lied to them and betrayed the revolution. But it was not just the celebrities. The media narrative was worthy of Orwellian fiction. Big Brother was in control. And how does Big Brother drive masses? Simple. Step 1, create an enemy. Step 2, make sure it speaks English. Step 3, rinse and repeat. English as a criminal language. A second language is usually a great addition to your resume wherever you are. It improves your chances of getting hired and might take you to unforeseeable places. The same more or less applies in Egypt. Speaking English in Egypt can improve your chances of getting arrested and visiting an Egyptian jail. Egyptians are welcoming people when it comes to foreigners. After all, our habit of supplying tourist attractions is not just second nature, but it is important to the economy. Egypt needs your money, and not just in the form of military and economic aid. But how does a foreign language change from being a way to communicate with tourists to a national security crisis? Well, leave it up to Big Brother, or as we call it, our father in the intelligence. For more than 6 decades, Egypt was controlled by the military apparatus. They controlled everything, from security to the economy to the media. The Soviet Union might have died in the 80s, but it still lives in our region. Whenever the military intelligence felt threatened, foreigners were always an easy target to blame. We were first aware of the dangers of the English language by way of a video that I had used in one of my earliest online episodes. It became an iconic landmark showing the way state-run propaganda operates. Referred to as Weeping Tamer, this video shows a young man named Tamer calling in to one of the TV news bulletins on the government channel. In a teary voice, he describes how he joined the masses in the streets in good faith, but now he wants to repent because he has discovered the evil plots behind this so-called revolution. Can you please tell us what you saw that made you reach this conclusion? Asks the anchor. These people are not Egyptians. They are not from here. They want to destroy the country, explains Tamer, his crying taking up most of his conversation. Yes, but can you please tell us what you saw? Asks the anchor again. These people are weird and they speak English very, very well. I remember translating that video for an American friend of mine, and his response was, where the fuck were those people when I was asking directions to the pyramids? That was enough to plant the first seeds of doubt in the hearts of people watching the revolution from home. Many calls from other alleged Weeping Tamers came flooding in. the story was more or less the same. Young men drawn into the revolution now saw the light. They claimed they were tricked by external powers and their operatives, who could speak perfect English. After Mubarak stepped down, we learned that the original Weeping Tamer was actually a network employee who was patching in from the control room as part of a staged phone call. These phone calls were now a comical yet disheartening reminder of how media manipulated people at the time. During the uprising in those 18 days, people who didn't understand or support the revolution also didn't realize that behind the scenes a covert operation was taking place to further implicate foreigners. Egyptian television was busy interviewing proud Egyptians who had captured and turned in foreigners of all nationalities. "We found two people walking on the bridge," said one citizen to a mainstream media source. "When they didn't give a good answer for why they were walking around like that, we turned them into the army. They turned out to be Irish." Actually, I could believe that. Only the Irish would be drunk enough to walk around in the middle of the night in the Middle Eastern country while the largest unrest in its history was occurring. A celebrity singer called in and claimed that he and some of his neighbors had just captured two Swiss Islamists. Now, this is a scenario that's very hard to imagine. Were they yodeling about their radical neutrality? Was Switzerland invading us with scrumptious chocolates? But these were not mere rumors. To many citizens of Egypt, this was strong evidence that foreigners were involved in the revolution. State-run media showed videos and photos of foreigners in the middle of Tahrir, dancing with the protesters. Of course, it may be worth mentioning that one of the biggest tourist spots, the Museum of Egyptian Antiquities, is just 200 yards away from the square. Imagine retired senile tourists walking out of the museum to find themselves in the middle of a revolution that was not exactly a part of their predetermined travel tour. But why not get a free treat and take in some of the local fare? Or you could believe that these dim-witted white folks who just happened to be in Egypt, checking off an item on their bucket list, were highly trained coverts. I mean, it's your choice. Egypt is a tourist destination, and the authorities were shooting themselves in the foot by denying this. As a matter of fact, in the next few years, the government would move from capturing tourists to killing them with fighter jets in the desert. Stick around, more of that to come. To them, national security was of the utmost priority. It didn't matter if you alienated foreigners or Egyptians themselves. The country came first, even at the country's expense. It didn't matter how ridiculous the claims were. Like when the 9 o'clock news proudly announced the arrest of 50 Eritreans and 35 Ethiopians for espionage. Even our African brothers were onto us. The bottom line is, the state-run media were doing a great job of making it appear that everybody was against the revolution, and they had no better weapon than the source of all evil, the one we love to hate and hate for loving, the Satan we all admire, the mighty U.S. of A. America, we love to hate you. When people in the West ask me how we Arabs, Muslims, and Middle Eastern folks feel about America, I sum it up like this. We hate your guts, but we would kill to get your visa. America was cited as the reason for everything evil that happened during the revolution. The revolutionaries accused America of supporting Mubarak and not moving fast enough to get him out. And the media accused America of staging the whole Arab Spring to destabilize the region. When they produced evidence that some of the revolution's leaders were paid operatives, there were calls pouring in on TV outing the fact that many of the so-called revolutionaries and the thousands of people taking to the streets were only protesting because they were paid $50 and given a bucket meal from KFC. It only makes sense that fake protesters were bolstered with food from a fake chicken kernel. How finger-licking American. What Western think tanks get wrong all the time is that they believe they can actually figure out how we feel about America through geopolitical, socioeconomic, and cultural bullshit. This will never work. Their best bet is to hire a therapist to analyze us. In the 1950s and 60s, under President Gamal Abdel Nasser, our first ever military dictator, Egypt was leaning toward the Soviet camp of communism. So, of course, we hated America. The U.S. has always supported Israel, vetoed every single Security Council resolution against them. and turned a blind eye every time they bombed the shit out of the Palestinians. Everyone had their reasons to hate America. Islamists, the military, leftists, liberals, and even poor taxi drivers. America is an easy target toward which to direct your hate in Egypt. If you are a leader and can't run the country properly, just convince the people that America is ruining everything. America is the devil for the Islamists because it wants to defeat Islam. We are enormous hypocrites, though, because while America empowers and financially assists Israel, our biggest enemy, we, at the same time, receive some of the largest chunks of American military aid. Meanwhile, Egyptian leftists hate America because it represents everything ugly about capitalism and world domination, while secular elitists hate America because it has empowered the extreme religious monarchies in the Gulf region, who ironically sponsor the extreme religious scholars who tell the people that America is fighting Islam. And the poor taxi driver hates America because he gets denied a visa to get away from all these crazy people. Nonetheless, this despised America is a dream destination for many of Egypt's hypocrites. Some of the most outspoken opponents of America send their kids to American schools and universities. When these people get sick, they travel to get treated in America. Their vacation retreats are mostly in the US and Europe, all paid for by the money they sucked from the poor people of Egypt while telling them that the reason they are poor is America. America and Israel are the excuses for all failures and government incompetence. I wouldn't really mind if Egypt actually manned up and had a serious hate-fueled relationship with them. But when it disses America and Israel while lying in bed with them for financial, security, and political arrangements, we really just come off like assholes. It is an interesting relationship in a country where people illegally download the latest episodes of Breaking Bad and Game of Thrones and fill the movie theaters for the latest Avengers movie. If Americans only knew how lucky they are that their endless lines are at Disney World, while ours are queues in front of the American embassy. The Day the Revolution Ended, Part 1. Many think the revolution ended in 2013, when the military took over. Yeah, we will come to that. Some think that it ended before that, when Islamists got hold of the country in 2012. I promise we will get to that too. In my opinion, the revolution ended only 9 weeks after Mubarak stepped down. Mubarak's rule was centered on one principal message: either me or absolute chaos. He made everyone believe that if he stepped down, Islamist extremists would win over Egypt and create another Afghanistan. This wasn't new. Throughout the Arab world, military dictators used this message as a tool to stay in power. This is why Western powers had no problem with Mubarak or other military leaders or dictators in the Middle East. For them, the likes of Mubarak represented stability, which is another word for taking care of America's interest in a discreet way without having to deal with public outcry. It's similar to the way America supported many dictators in Latin America to protect its interests from communists. That's why Castro was a real mindfucker. He was both a dictator and a communist. For Mubarak to maintain his position as the only option, he had to destroy any liberal or moderate opposition while keeping Islamic political power on a tight leash. And as such, there was no other alternative in case of his departure than bringing in Islamists. Mubarak officially stepped down on February 11, 2011, at which point the army took over for an interim rule and promised to hold elections the next year. But the army decided to quickly push a referendum vote on March 19th. On the surface, they made it look like the people were being given an opportunity to choose how the presidential office and constitution would operate moving forward. Quite simply, though, the referendum fucked up the beautiful mosaic that was the revolution. It showed the ugly face of political Islam and alienated many people from the idea of democracy. However, I really can't go on explaining why Egypt is such a clusterfuck without explaining what the hell Sharia law is or who makes up the various Islamist parties. So get ready for the worst explanation of political Islam and Sharia you may ever encounter. It may not be good enough to help you pass your Middle Eastern politics class, but it will do just fine for telling off your ignorant uncle at Thanksgiving. Lesson 1. Sharia Law. In my futile attempt to explain political Islam, I will have to use the word Sharia a lot. Now, if you think that you know what the hell it is, think again. We Muslims, all 1.5 billion of us, have yet to really agree on what this word means. A very stripped-down explanation is that Sharia is a collection of rules and laws that are inspired by the Quran. It includes the stories and traditions of the Prophet Muhammad, in addition to many rulings on Islamic laws and interpretations from what theologists concluded after the Prophet. For most people, their daily lives are dictated by Sharia and how it outlines the honorable way to approach issues like marriage, inheritance, charity donations, prayer, dietary rules such as abstaining from drinking or eating pork, and making sure that the meat you eat is halal, kosher, and how not to be an asshole. Other followers extend Sharia to mandate how women should dress, the length of a man's beard, and how to be a real asshole to other followers whom they deem less religious. Many take it even further and consider Sharia to be the undisputed law of God, including every single literal order and mandate of Sharia that has been in place for hundreds of years. They have taken a hold of Sharia's dogma by denying any attempts on interpretations to modernize the traditions. This is akin to applying the Bible's Old Testament as it was written. Could you imagine if your current boss forced all female employees to work in a completely separate office while they were menstruating because they were too unclean to mingle with men? How about stoning to death or beheading kids who cursed at their parents? There are about 50 countries in the world with Muslim majorities. Many of them have Sharia law as part of their constitution, and yet not everyone follows the literal or the most extreme interpretations. If you surveyed Muslims, the majority will say they prefer operating under Sharia law, but this doesn't mean they would want to live under ISIS or Al-Qaeda, which allegedly follows the most extreme interpretations. Just like many Americans could agree to live by the spirit of the Ten Commandments, but wouldn't want to take the religious rights doctrine as national law. What makes it confusing is that different groups of people choose whatever interpretation fits them best. Which interpretation wins out really depends on who has the power and the money to impose it. The Saudis are rich and have a lot of money to spread around, so their interpretation, the most extreme, Wahhabism one, takes all the marbles. I once had a heated discussion with a pro-Sharia Islamic scholar. He claimed that there is nothing wrong with Sharia and that we, as Muslims, should apply the best possible version. I asked him which Sharia he wants to apply. Which Islamic country now or even in the past 1500 years applied the best version of Sharia? And which religious scholars should carry that task? The ones in Saudi Arabia, the ones in Egypt, the ones in Iran, Indonesia, Malaysia, Algeria, Morocco? Which ones? He failed to answer. If you go back to the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, the scary image of terrorist Muslims shouting Sharia is nowhere to be found. So how did that fucked up version make a comeback? America's arch enemies, the Taliban, were on America's good side when the CIA was funding and arming them to beat the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. Even Hollywood loved the Mujahideen guerrilla militia types. That was obvious in Rambo 3. Do you remember that movie? It's so bad, it's good. It's where your all-American hero goes to Afghanistan to help the heroic Mujahideen against the horrible good-for-nothing Ruskies. A few years later, the real Soviet Union suddenly collapsed, and the American media needed a scarecrow, and we stepped in to fill the gap. News agencies, you're welcome. Okay, so as I was saying, for decades, the worst and most extreme interpretation of Sharia was fueled by Saudi money and their Wahhabi ideology. America goes along with it as long as they pump out the oil as fast as they pump the hate. But to be fair, it's not just Saudi Arabia. Many of the military regimes in the region love Sharia. You can't drive the masses with guns and tanks forever, so you need a more spiritual controlling tool, the good God himself. Sadat, our president before Mubarak, changed the constitution in 1980 to give himself unlimited presidential terms. And to pass this statute, he also had to make a drastic change in the constitution to appease the Muslim majority. He tweaked the Sharia article in the constitution to state that instead of Sharia is a source of legislation. Sharia is the source of legislation. It is a wonder how a couple of letters can fuck a whole country. A few months later, he was assassinated during a victory parade, and Mubarak later took full advantage of the unlimited terms article, allowing the Sharia clause to remain. Now, Egypt's law doesn't allow beheading, the removal of limbs, or the enforcement of many of the Wahhabi interpretations, but when needed, this article can be used to oppress free thinkers, minorities, or anything that is considered a threat. The military would use Sharia to show that they are the guardians of religion, and at the same time would let extreme radicals talk freely about their dream to apply an ISIS-like Sharia to scare everyone. It was the good old, it's either me or chaos, terrorism, jihad, etc. line. Most people, including authorities, who identify as Islamists and who call for Sharia and God's rule are fucking hypocrites. An Arab philosopher once said, if Muslims were given a choice to vote for either a secular or a religious state, they would vote for the religious state and flee to live in the secular one. We are too afraid of some ephemeral God to vote in our own self-interest. With this horrible and confusing explanation of one of the most used and abused words in today's Islamic discourse, now let's ask the next impossible to answer question. What the hell is political Islam?